I'd say the trends that we've seen over the last decade, we're seeing again on steroids this time around.
On this episode of the WNC Politics Podcast, a conversation about money in 2020. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along. The U.S. Postal Service swings by our house on the outskirts of Raleigh 6 days a week. And for the last couple of months, it has been rare to open the mailbox and not retrieve some political advertisement. My wife is an educated white mom and a registered unaffiliated voter. Her name is Blair. In late summer, I started stacking these mailers on the back steps. On Monday, I put them all on the kitchen table and asked Blair to take a gander.
Tell us. The Lincoln Project.
In all, 46 pieces of campaign mail. Full disclosure, I already recycled about a dozen letters from the Center for Voter Information about how to request a mail-in ballot. But yes, 46.
Tell us. I thought there was going to be a little bit more diversity in these, honestly. We just went through like 25 or 30, and they were 90% Tillis or Cunningham. I mean, none of the one that I want to keep is the voter guide, and that is the one I actually pulled this out when we got it and looked through it. The rest of these are pretty much trash.
Billions of dollars are being spent during this election cycle. That's with a B. It flows through several entities, federal and state campaigns, political action committees, PACs, and super PACs, often referred to as dark money groups, which make independent expenditures, or IEs. According to the website Advertising Analytics, $6.5 billion has already been doled out for political ads in this election cycle. Few states will see more political spending in 2020 than North Carolina. After all, we're a presidential battleground, and the Tillis-Cunningham race may serve as the tipping point for power in the U.S. Senate. On top of all that, as you've heard here on recent Politics Podcast episodes, power at the state legislature is also up for grabs. Winner gets to do redistricting, cultivate power, and shape policy in the state for likely the next decade. Collectively, the stakes are incredibly high. The presidential campaigns are spending millions on TV time. Those campaign mailers, which my wife rifled through a moment ago, begin at a cost of a few $1,000s for legislative campaigns. Now, since Citizens United, the landmark Supreme Court ruling 10 years ago that allowed for unlimited and anonymous political contributions, so-called dark money from those super PACs has proliferated. However, the saturation of money is not entirely new.
It's my pleasure to introduce and welcome Jesse Helms, the Republican candidate, and Jim Hunt, the Democratic candidate.
North Carolina's U.S. Senate race of 1984 was, at the time, the most expensive non-presidential political campaign in American history. Inundated with money, cluttered with misinformation.
My positions have been distorted a great deal. Tonight, we're sitting right here together, just a few feet across from each other, and I will be delighted to answer and give my position on anything you want to ask me.
Mr. Helms?
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Well, that's an interesting development, and let's just try one on for size.
Oodles and oodles of cash, plenty of it from groups outside the state. Then 6 years ago, North Carolina again laid claim to hosting the most costly U.S. Senate race in history.
Now to vote 2014, where access to cash was mandatory, especially in the Senate race, spending topped more than $100 million.
A good chunk of that came from sources outside the state. Senator Kay Hagan and challenger Tom Tillis, along with their backers.
Now in 2020, the Cunningham-Tillis contest has reached never-before-seen levels of fundraising and spending in a U.S. Senate race. Candidly, there are a myriad of threads to this financial conversation. We're going to cover only a sliver of what is a big, complicated equation in a roundtable discussion. To add some insight, we're going to hear from three people. Anna Beaven Gravely is the executive director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, a nonpartisan group. Jeremy Borden is a journalist, researcher, and volunteer with the Raleigh chapter of Code for America, an organization trying to improve government transparency. And Dr. Eric Heberlig is a professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. We gathered via Zoom on Monday afternoon, and I began broadly by asking each of them what stands out from what we know thus far about money and politics here in 2020.
I would say the thing that really jumps out to me when I think about North Carolina's races is actually the massive divide that exists between our candidates for governor. We've got Governor Cooper, who has raised over $19 million, and we have Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, who's raised just over $7 million. And I think that is a really interesting look at North Carolina in where the money is and how the money is breaking down.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, frankly, it's how little we really know about, you know, I think a lot of focus gets put on big dollar amounts and spending and ad spending. And I think that's fine. And I'm glad that, you know, in some ways gets some focus and sort of, you know, sort of the national media kind of drives that in terms of trying to understand what campaigns are doing and, you know, who's spending money where. But I think, you know, as North Carolina's citizens and voters, I think what really stands out to me is how little we really know and understand about who's giving this money and why. If people want to understand why government looks the way that it looks and why policy decisions are the way that they are, I wouldn't say that campaign finance is the only thing to look at, but I would say that it's one of the big things. And I think that the fact that we don't have our arms around it says a lot about where we are as a state and as a democracy.
Professor?
I'd say the trends that we've seen over the last decade, we're seeing again on steroids this time around. North Carolina has been a magnet for big spending races for outside money over the past decade in particular, and we're seeing that again, particularly in the presidential and Senate race.
Some additional basic context as we get into it. Citizens United is likely here for a while, despite there being some grassroots energy around reversing it. There is no legitimate challenge at this point, and the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court is what it is. Raising the most money does not necessarily mean political victory. And campaign finance is opaque. Details remain elusive. To that point, Anna, with NC Free Enterprise, has been working on a portal to try to make tracking campaign contributions a little less arduous.
So this dashboard has been a labor of love. It's really taken a good portion of this year for us to be able to assign campaign IDs to committees and make sure that we are not double reporting information. But all of this work that we've put into it and the amount of time that it's taken really does reinforce for me just the need to have, just the need to fully understand and be able to have a conversation about campaign finance without having to get a master's degree in campaign finance. Because I feel like that's sort of where we are right now because of Citizens United, because of campaign finance restrictions. Money will exist in politics forever. It's just going to go into different places. And we want to be able to know where those places are.
So what, if anything, will the portal do differently or better or more transparently than what we might be able to access through the State Board of Elections at this point in time?
So it takes a really long time to search through and comb through all of the information that's on the State Board of Elections. With this dashboard, you'll have it in one view. And you can, and it'll give you a broad sweeping overview of how much money do Democrats have, how much money do Republicans have, what are the top raising candidate campaigns, and what are the top PACs. And that gives you more information at your fingertips to be able to search for more information. Information begets information.
It is laborious and is difficult for even for people who know this subject to be able to roll things up in a meaningful way. Different groups like Anna's group, other good government groups, academics, journalists need to have this stuff at their fingertips. And there's no reason for it not to be at their fingertips. The transparency, you know, this is required. Many of these things are required to be transparent and accessible. And it's really about using data solutions to make them even more so. I think that that's just the beginning, because using that data, making sense of it, understanding it, and understanding it in a way where people can really draw the links between policy and between money, you know, that sort of goes beyond the basic transparency that we're going for. You got to have the transparency first. You can't do any of the other work without that basic baseline.
Yeah, it doesn't do the citizens of North Carolina much good if the state requires campaigns and political action committees to report all this donations and spending, if the public can't access the information and therefore doesn't know whether their local representative is getting X amount of dollars from Duke Energy or Bank of America, and can figure out, oh, well, they might be voting in this way because they've gotten these contributions. So there needs to be ways where reporters especially can get this information quickly and translate it for the public. If we're relying on the public to figure out whether there's some type of untoward relationship between a legislator and a donor, they need to know what that financial transaction is in time to be able to make a decision. And if we can't report on it, and if interest groups can't highlight these scenarios, it really doesn't serve the purpose of having the law in the first place.
So one of the things I'm wondering, potentially for all of you to speak to, but certainly Professor Heberlig, down in your neck of the woods, we've got Bank of America and American Airlines, Duke Energy, and some big political donors, at least historically, across the last several decades. As we think about a landscape that has certainly changed significantly since the Citizens United ruling, I'm wondering how, and you've in your research have spent a lot of time looking at congressional campaigns and contributions. Have we seen wholesale changes in who is donating money and how money is flowing? Or is it really the same landscape and the amounts have just increased?
Well, we've certainly seen the amounts increase, but we've also seen how the money it flows into campaigns change pretty significantly. We've seen since the advent of internet-based fundraising, lots of small donors come into the system. Since Citizens United, we've seen a lot more spending on outside interest groups coming in, super PACs raising lots of money. But one thing that I don't think we expected when Citizens United was announced, I think the expectation was that lots of corporations would just open their treasuries and buy their own ads or give it to super PACs. And we really haven't seen that. Much of the funding for super PACs is given by wealthy individuals. So in some ways, it's corporate money in the sense that these many of the people work for corporations, but they're donating it as individuals. It's not like Bank of America is fronting a super PAC or giving lots of money to trade association PACs. So it's still that obviously people with money have more ability to dominate the campaign finance system, but corporations are more relying on their traditional political action committees to get money into politics rather than using super PACs as a new means of doing it.
I think one thing that I just want to bring up, because we keep talking about the negative side effects of this amount of money in our political system and the negative side effects of Citizens United, there are some good things that come with it as well. I think that there's a level of protection for higher donors, for individuals like you said before, who want to participate in the political system, but in a society where we are seeing more and more riots, we're seeing more and more protests individuals who are invested in an outcome, not for purely selfish reasons, but are invested around ideas that benefit not only that individual, but also lots of other individuals. And once you start putting limits on the amount of money that people can give to individual campaigns, you're going to see it, the water spill over the cup and go somewhere else. And one thing that I thought was interesting, and we keep talking about the increase that Citizens United has brought to this decade in campaign spending, but to put that in context, we have nationally since 2010 to 2018 in the midterm elections, we've seen increased IE spending by 8 times. And in presidential campaigns of 12 to 16, it's just about doubled. I think we will probably see a massive increase in 2020 just because we seem to be breaking every record that has ever existed. But 68% of the spending of super PACs in 2018 came from donors who gave more than $1 million. And so we're still seeing large amounts of money invested in ideas, whether it's to tear down a candidate for what they stand for or to build up a candidate for what they stand for.
I just don't know that we are having, yes, we're having a conversation around the ideas that, as you said, people with over $1 million to throw at politics want to have. Those are the conversations that we get to have in our democracy. And look, I mean, I think you make some good points in terms of like, giving a political donation should not automatically participate. You know, that is a way to participate in democracy. And what Citizens United found was that essentially corporations and individuals should be able to stay anonymous, that this it was a free speech decision, you know, that also overruled a bipartisan act of Congress, the McCain-Feingold Act, and really has put, you know, so this was a court decision, a Supreme Court decision of an unelected body that overruled a bipartisan act that required disclosure and limited spending. It basically was trying to level the playing field for everybody else.
I wonder if you think, to Jeremy's point, we're at risk of fringing on a plutocracy in some ways, if we are at risk of drowning out some of the smaller voices, some of the less funded voices and ideas because of the current landscape.
I'll say that I think that's always going to be a risk. I think that is always going to be a concern.
So I think there's two different ways that the spending plays out. One is a potential distortion of the agenda. But I think the other way that money can potentially have a deleterious influence on democracy is if that's what voters are really reacting to. If somebody has the money and we're reacting to their name recognition or the fact that they're dominating the messages we see and we vote for them rather than perhaps a more qualified candidate or somebody with better ideas, that's a problem too. But I think the caveat to that is, in most of the high-profile races and most of the competitive races, voters are hearing lots from both sides. So, yeah, we're seeing lots of outside spending, but we're seeing lots of outside spending on behalf of both candidates or attacking both candidates. So in some ways, that's lots of money that's canceling out the money on the other side. Yeah, in the end, it may make a difference, but voters are kind of fully informed by having all that money spent. Where I'm more concerned about the influence of the outside money is in lower profile races where voters don't have alternative sources of information, especially if all that money is really coming in only on one side. So judges' races, for example, voters know very little about judges. If there's a group that comes in there, spends a lot, particularly in the last week when the other side doesn't have the ability to counteract, that frankly is going to dominate the information that voters have and is probably going to swing the election to the candidate that benefits from that outside spending. But in things like presidential races, Senate races, congressional races, where both sides are spending so much, I think it's more like an arms race dynamic where both sides are just spending to keep up with the other side. And for voters, they just hear a cacophony of stuff that they, in the end, probably tune out.
Dr. Eric Haberlig is a professor at UNC Charlotte. Jeremy Borden is a journalist and volunteer with the Raleigh chapter of Code for America. He asked that I share his email in the event you're interested in connecting with him. It's nccampaignfinance@gmail.com. And Anna Beaven-Gravely is the executive director at the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. She's on Twitter at ABGRAVELY. The early voting polls are open. The survey polls are tight, at least here in North Carolina. Next week, we're working on collecting and then sharing some voter voices from across the state. If you are interested in telling us a little bit about your voting experience in 2020, DM me on Twitter, J_TIBS, or shoot me an email, JTIBERII@WUNC.org. Thanks for downloading, listening, and engaging. We'll invade your podcast feed again on Friday when Aisha Dhu and Clark Reamer stop by for a review of the week's political news. Talk to you soon.
Donald Trump, Dubai, 2020. Thank you.